My name is Bill Hooks. I represent the petitioner in regards to this case for the court. This case originally arose out of a settlement of a products liability lawsuit in Cameron County, Texas. My client, Cherney Industries, and one other defendant agreed and entered into an agreed settlement as to a minor plaintiff. Under the terms of that agreed settlement, which was entered into, an annuity was set up for the minor plaintiff that had a present value of approximately $243,000. There was another of approximately $90,000 that was placed in an interest-bearing account in order that the minor plaintiff's mother could draw on it for monthly allowance. The third item of the settlement provided for a payment of approximately $200,000 into the registry of the court. The respondent in this case was appointed by the trial judge as guardian ad litem to review the settlement to advise the court as to whether the settlement should be accepted. There was a hearing held finalizing the settlement and entry of the settlement judgment in this case. At that hearing, the guardian ad litem testified as to what services he had performed in regard to his service as guardian ad litem. After the hearing was held, the trial court ruled that a reasonable fee for the guardian ad litem in this matter was $15,000. It is my position and the position of my client that the trial court, clearly abused its discretion in awarding the $15,000 guardian ad litem fee. Basically,
the hearing recorded, is there a statement of facts on the hearing at which the trial judge made the award of $15,000?
Yes, sir. The evidence is basically undisputed in regard to this relevant matter before the court. Is the only testimony or the only evidence that was had or contained at the hearing and the statement of fact before the court was the testimony of the guardian ad litem as what he did. So the evidence is undisputed that our case will either rise or fall on the testimony of the guardian ad litem.
He testified that he had worked before 15 hours in the case.
Yes, sir. And he went into a little more detail, and I'll go into that in a minute, as to what he did. From reviewing the brief of the respondent or the appellee at the Court of Appeals level, I basically don't think there's any dispute as to what the controlling law is in the case. It's basically an interpretation of that law. This court recently held in the Simon versus York Crane Company, which is quoted in the briefs and in the Court of Appeals opinion, I believe, that the same factors in determining the reasonableness of a guardian ad litem fee should be used and are controlling in determining the reasonableness of a guardian ad litem fee.
Would you state that again?
It didn't make any sense, did you?
No.
The same factors should be used in determining the reasonableness of a guardian ad litem fee as are used in determining the reasonableness of attorney's fees. Now, there are a number of those factors. The respondent interpreting our position is apparently stating that that we are arguing that only one factor should be used, and that is the number of hours that are spent on the case. You know, that's not our position. I agree and think that the matters as generally set out in the Simon case and the quoted Court of Appeals case are relevant factors to be used. I would submit that in this particular case, considering the evidence or the testimony of the guardian ad litem, that probably the most important factor is the time that he spent. His testimony was that he spent 12 to 15 hours in his service as guardian ad litem. Other factors which the court has clearly set out in its in the Simon case, and the courts have set out in the authority quoted in the Simon case, is the importance and the nature of the services rendered. This particular case, the guardian ad litem testified that he had several telephone conversations with plaintiff's counsel concerning the proposed settlement and the nature of the case. He also testified that he had one office conference or meeting with the plaintiff's counsel. He said that he reviewed two depositions to give him a feel of the case. He met with the minor's mother to discuss the proposed settlement. And he prepared a guardian ad litem report, which is contained in the transcript. In addition, he testified that he had one meeting and three telephone conversations with bankers in order to determine where to place the $200,000 that was being tendered into the registry of the court. After the hearing, the transcript indicates that he filed a report recommending where the money should be deposited. Now this is from clearly and undisputedly from the statement of facts, this is all that the guardian ad litem did in this case. He did not participate in a trial, obviously, since there was no trial. He did not participate in negotiating the settlement, which he was asked to review and give his recommendations to the trial court. Contrary to what the Court of Appeals opinion indicated, he did not have anything to do with the fee arrangement that was entered into or transpired between the minor plaintiff and his counsel, whereby there were no attorney's fees charged the minor plaintiff, but that the minor's mother absorbed all the attorney's fees in the case. Another factor that I would think was of prime importance, and what the court has said is of importance, is the responsibility that was imposed on the counsel, or in this case, the guardian ad litem. It doesn't appear to me that there was any great amount of responsibility. Procedurally, of course, he had the responsibility to review the settlement and to recommend to the court whether it be approved or disapproved. And, you know, I'm not belating that responsibility because it is a safeguard and it is an important responsibility. But
Mr. Hooks, excuse me for interrupting, but sure. The Court of Appeals put great emphasis on the fact that you did not object, or counsel for your client did not object to the attorney Lighten fee, which is, at the time it was announced.
That is,
could you speak to that?
Yes, sir. You know, I found that a little strange. Is we had a hearing, the trial court entered made its ruling as to a $15,000 attorney's guardian ad litem fee. Yes, at least Judge Spears knows. In my earlier days as an attorney, I would argue with the trial court about their rulings, but I've learned that that's probably to no avail that you can disagree, but simply to argue with them about their opinion is a waste of everybody's time. Procedurally, I protected the appeal in that I filed a motion for reconsideration or a rehearing as to this point. The trial judge did not set the hearing, and it was overruled as a matter of law. But you know, I don't believe that anything was waived or that it would have been prudent or even one of these things. Looking back in retrospect, it seems to me that I wouldn't have done it any different.
So you filed a motion for reconsideration, which was just not set for a hearing. Did you request a hearing in the first place?
I don't recall, but I don't believe I did. I think there was a motion filed for rehearing or for a new trial, and that since one wasn't set, that we just let it be overruled as by operation of law.
Then you filed a request for, or you mailed in a request for finding the facts and conclusions of the law on this issue.
Yes, sir. You know, it's out of the scope of the record, and I guess...
Well, just complain something about the record.
You say you didn't argue with the judge about the fee he set. Did you suggest to the judge what fee that you thought would be proper under the circumstances?
Prior, Your Honor, to the...
On the record.
There was nothing.
How can you say then that the trial judge abused his discretion if you never told him what you thought a reasonable fee would be? You just left it up to the trial judge, and then after he ruled, you said, well, I'm not happy with that ruling.
Well, I believe that the trial judge, that it's his responsibility from hearing the evidence, it's his responsibility to establish assess a reasonable fee from hearing the evidence.
What do you think a reasonable fee would have been?
Well, in my opinion, if you consider all the facts and the evidence in the record, a reasonable fee would have been the hours that this man spent times his hourly rate, which would have been approximately, I don't know, $1,200.
Would you say that a fee of $15,000 could never be reasonable for an ad litem service where only 12 to 15 hours have been spent thus far, considering the fact that sometimes these cases involve quite a bit of time in the future for which the ad litem has no source of recompense?
You know, I wouldn't go that far. I would say in some situations, depending on the other relevant factors, that a $15,000 fee could, under some circumstances, be reasonable.
Well, in the absence of findings of fact and conclusions of law, doesn't a court have to indulge in every reasonable inference to support the decision of the trial court?
No, sir. I think that the court has to look at the evidence. And if it's any support in the evidence, they have to indulge the evidence that's in the favor of supporting the trial judge's theory of the evidence that is in the record.
Could the fact that there was so much money that was left for future distribution, I presume this $90,000 that mother could draw on wasn't just hers to draw on without court approval or without somebody supervising the money. And additionally, the annuity probably would require, potentially would require some supervision.
Well, as I recall,
in the absence of findings of fact and conclusions of law, wouldn't an appellate court be extremely presumptuous in disturbing this discretion of the trial court?
Well, as I interpret what this award was made for, and which is apparently, as I understand it, what the guardian ad litem now interprets the award, that it was made for the services which he rendered in getting this judgment entered and approving the judgment and talking to the financial institutions about paying where to place the money, and also to file with the court the statement or as to what his recommendations was placing the money. I don't believe that it's the intent of the rule, or should it be the intent of the rules of civil procedure, that the court at the settlement of a case must make a guardian ad litem fee in such an amount for which the guardian should be compensated for anything that he may or may not do in the future. Nor do I think it's fair to...
Do you think they could call your clients or your client's insurance company back in 5 years from now and give more money because the situation is getting complicated?
Well, I feel that my client or any client who's paying court costs should pay a guard, of which the guardian ad litem fee is assessed as part, that they should pay the cost of finalizing the settlement and the judgment to see that the rights of the minor are protected and that the settlement and judgment is in the benefit of the minor. I don't think that a defendant or a person paying the judgment has the obligation to be responsible for any guardian ad litem or attorney's fees that may be incurred 5 or 10 years down the line.
And how does the judge take care of it at the time of the hearing or any future work that the guardian ad litem may be called upon to perform?
Well, I feel that that is, as a practical matter, an impossibility where the trial court really cannot anticipate what may occur in the future, nor should the guardian ad litem be asked to make his service available for 10, 20 years until the minor reaches the majority. If there are other fees or other services that need to be rendered, then I think that's something that would reasonably come out of the guardian's estate. In this particular case, the guardian ad litem's position is that he rendered his services and completed his services when he filed that last report.
Well, what about the reinvestment of money into a better interest-bearing account? Since it was probably the guardian ad litem initially who recommended which account the money would go into, you think that the minor ought to have to pay in the future for work the guardian ad litem does and possibly changing to a better interest-bearing account?
Well, really, I think probably the more proper perspective to look at it, that the work that's done in the future in regard to the guardian, the minor's estate, is probably something that would more practically be done through a guardianship, where the same criteria or acknowledging and applying, where somebody would have to go back into the court to petition for changes of reinvestment or money or whatever, but this would be something that the guardian's estate should pay.
You know, you're about to run out of time, and you've got a law point on presentment and finding the fact, which I think is a very interesting point, and you may do well
okay.
to get to that point.
You've had a chance over the rebuttal to collect your thoughts on this other, but I would like to hear this other findings of fact point, too.
In regard to the findings of fact, the facts relative to this matter are as follows. I prepared a request for findings of fact and conclusions of law on May the 27th of 1987. The judgment was entered on May the 20th of 1987. The original was sent to the trial judge with a copy sent to the district clerk.
How was it sent to the trial judge?
Both to the trial judge and to the district clerk.
How? By mail?
Certified
by
mail.
Delivery?
Certified mail, Your Honor.
You have a certified receipt card? Was it entered into
Yes, sir.
Who signed the certified receipt card?
It was signed by, I assume, a clerk or a secretary at the judge's office.
I was under the impression there's no dispute about the fact that it was requested by certified mail at the time, and so...
I'm not aware of any dispute.
Yeah. Just get right to the point as to whether or not you have to physically hand it to the judge or whether you can do it by certified mail. Just get right straight to it. Is it time is limited?
I believe that clearly the intent of the rule that you comply with it by sending certified mail, and that Rule 21 of the Rules of Civil Procedure should apply. of interest in a case that I just found yesterday when I was preparing for arguments is a case of Daugherty versus Super Spray. It's 738 Southwest 2nd, 785. It's a 1987 Fort Worth Court of Appeals, no risk. This case basically sustains or follows my alternative logic in this case, that as long as you file the request for findings of fact and conclusions of law timely with the district clerk, that it's not necessary to timely file or present the same with the trial judge. In this case, it's the same contention as the respondent, that while my return receipt was received timely on the last day, that the clerk of the court didn't see fit to stamp it filed until the next day. It's the same situation in the Daugherty case, and they say that the Rule 296 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure does not require that it be presented to the trial judge within 10 days, as long as it's filed with the district court within 10 days and presented to the trial judge, that's substantial compliance.
Well, you throw in "and presented to the trial judge."
Lassiter requires that.
We have any evidence in the record that the trial judge ever saw these requests for findings and conclusions?
Yes, sir.
And what is that?
Well, we have three things. We sent it with certified mail. We have the return receipt.
But not signed by the judge.
No. Secondly, we have the request that was received by the court and stamp received a day later. Third,
by the clerk.
Thirdly, on June the 11th, 1987, what a week after the June 2nd, we then have the judge acknowledging receipt of the, or the review of the findings, the request.
How long was that after they were due?
They were due on June the 2nd, I believe, and it was June the 11th when the judge actually
acknowledged
receipt.
That was in writing.
Yes, sir. It's on the court's copy of the trial court's copy of the request.
If I understand your argument, there's nothing about actual physical presentment to the judge in the rules, at least not as they're currently written. But that is a requirement that this court has imposed on the rules in Lassiter versus Bliss. Am I correct so far?
Yes, sir. What my argument initially is that as a practical matter, presentment has got to be, you've met that burden.
Well, just help me through this. There's nothing about presentment in the rules.
It says they will be presented to the trial judge.
Right. Nothing requiring physical, actual.
No, nor is there anything in the rules that specifically requires that presentment must be within the 10-day period.
That's my question. And Lassiter doesn't specifically say that. But would you have us impose any kind of, should there be some kind of reasonable deadline? If you're arguing the case in the appellate court, you get in this problem, if you run down and stick it under the trial judge's nose at that time, is that sufficient?
No, sir. I think if you're going to require that there's a presentment to the judge, that there needs to be, it needs to be presented to him within some reasonable time so he can comply. My argument is that, as a practical matter, that the person requesting the findings of fact and conclusions of law should have met that burden by delivering such a request certified mail to his office. The only other alternative is that you physically go down, catch him, and make him sign it. Otherwise, you're a victim of when the clerk decides to stamp it filed or when the judge decides to read his mail.
You're not contending, are you, that a mere filing with the clerk satisfies the rule?
No, sir. I think you have to go further than that. But I don't think that you have to, within the 10-day period, physically present it to the judge, or at least that's what the Daugherty case said, interpreting the last bit.
How many, just for curiosity's sake, was this a multi-county district court?
No, sir.
Well,
but under, what you're saying...
There that go into Williston County,
right? I don't know.
If
I don't think it's a multi-county court, but I may...
It's a two-county court. All four district judges.
If a trial judge tried a non-jury trial and then took a two-week vacation immediately after signing the judgment, then if we require actual physical presentment, you would have to go to Tahiti or Hawaii or wherever the judge happened to go under a physical presentment rule. Is that correct?
Well, that's my point. It places a impractical and in some situations an impossible burden on the attorney presented, particularly in this case where we're out of county counsel.
This judge held court for the Cameron County?
Yes, sir.
That's what town?
Brownsville.
How far is Brownsville from San Antonio?
250 miles, I guess, sir.
So it's your position you wouldn't have to drive the 250 miles or fly it or get there any other way, just to personally hand it to the judge in order to comply with the rule. That's what you're saying.
Well, I would think that interpretation would be overly harsh and shouldn't be.
It was a friendly question in case you didn't recognize.
You're right, I know it.
Well, where do you draw the line? Just filing it with the clerk is not sufficient. But if the judge happens to have a deputy clerk and you get a green card, is that sufficient? I mean,
I feel that ought to be sufficient. That if you deliver.
What if you're in a county with no deputy clerk? And can you just file it with the clerk? I mean, I'm trying to understand what kind of line we should draw here.
Well, the Rule 21A, I think, helps some in that it says that generally, which I believe should be applied to this situation, that it's 3 days after you mail it. You know, I believe if you mail a letter certified mail to the trial court, that it should be assumed received by him 3 days after after it's mailed. Now, whether it's a deputy clerk or the judge signs it himself, but
so you don't address it to the clerk. I'm trying to harmonize your answer to Judge Kilgarlin. Addressing it to the clerk is not sufficient. It needs to be addressed to the judge. But then who signs it is not important, as long as that's some official.
The certified mail?
Right.
Well, as a practical matter, as we all know, certified mail is sent out commonly, and it's usually signed in a law office by the secretary or the receptionist, or it's hardly ever signed by the lawyer.
Yeah, but can't you pay a fee and get it signed by the addressee?
No.
That ain't abolished.
Well, we had to change Rule 106.
That's what I thought he had to do is refuse to sign it.
What I'm concerned about, and I don't know what it's like in Bexar County or Cameron County, but in Harris County, if you file it with the clerk, that's absolutely no guarantee at all that the judge is ever going to see that instrument. And that's what we're concerned about, is making sure that the judge is put on reasonable notice.
Well, there may be some confusion, Your Honor, with what we mean by clerk. I filed it in this particular case with the district clerk's office. I sent it certified mail. I also sent it certified mail to the trial judge.
Addressed to him personally?
Yes, sir. His clerk is the one that I assume signed the return receipt.
That's a deputy district clerk.
Yes, but in his
office. There is no clerk that works for the judge.
Sometimes they have secretaries.
The 103 district court has a secretary.
But I addressed the letter to the trial judge. I sent a copy to the district clerk.
All four district judges in Cameron County have a secretary.
Thank you.
We'll see you in a minute. We're now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Dale Robertson on behalf of respondent Juan Magallanes. Just to touch on some of the points that have been raised by the petitioner in this case, first dealing with the issue as far as the request for a finding of fact. I was unaware that the Postal Service had changed the rules either. In the transcript, though, at page 377, the particular return receipt card involved in this case does have a box for restricted delivery. So presumably, by paying an additional fee, the petitioner in this case could have restricted delivery to the judge, and of course, then we wouldn't have a worry as far as when it was physically presented to the judge.
Suppose the judge is not there then. Maybe he's out for a couple of days.
Well, certainly if the trial court...
You're going to make that the determining factor as to whether or not a request is timely filed? You can't do that.
Well, I think it has to be presented to the court. Of course, if the court, through maliciousness, refuses to sign it, or attempts to avoid it. I think that can be brought up.
Oh, you think that can be proved?
Well, I think it can be attempted to be proved.
Come on.
I don't know that any attorney would be eager to enter into such a battle.
Now you're getting realistic.
But I would suggest that there's certainly the presumption should be that the trial court is acting properly. There's a lot of paper that goes through a judge's office. There's a lot of paper that goes through the clerk's office. And I think the requirement is reasonable that it be presented to the judge, to the judge see it at some point.
That's the reason for the wording in the rule. What we're looking for is how to accomplish that in a fair way to the person making the request and to the judge who's going to receive the request. No one disputes the fact that tons of mail comes into every, at least the Metropolitan District Court clerk every day. Some of it's addressed to the judge, some of it's addressed to the clerk. But what we're looking for is a method. Now help us find that method.
Well, I think today the method is clear to those who wish to have the court make findings of fact and conclusions of law. I think today one who has studied
the case law and the rule knows that it must be presented to the judge.
Now,
within
time out, what part of the rule are you relying on? Rule 296 or 297?
It is not in the rule. Okay. It is in case law.
That's right. I just want to make that there is nothing in the rule that says anything other than that the party shall make a request to the judge.
That's correct.
Now, if the judge doesn't do anything, then you have to call the omission to the attention of the judge, which is maybe a little bit stronger. But the first thing just says you have to, Rule 296, initially you just have to make a request.
That's correct.
Now, the case law is Lassiter versus Bliss. And it said it must be presented to the judge. And that's all it says, right?
That's correct.
Nothing about physical presentation.
No, it doesn't specify physical presentation.
And it also doesn't have a time deadline.
It does not.
So that's the parameters of what we're operating under.
That's correct. My interpretation of Lassiter and reading that along with the rule is one today who is seeking such findings and conclusions from the court knows that it must be presented to him and that most people have seen that to be the judge has to see it. And that can be accomplished by different methods. There is no specification in the rule as to any means or manner of doing that. There's no specification in the rule or in the case law to answer your question about, well, what if the judge is gone during all that period of time? But as of today, and of course the court could change this without changing the rule, as of today, the presentment is required when one looks at the cases that this court has handed down, and I don't think that's an unreasonable requirement upon one who wants to call this to the attention of the very busy trial judges we have in this state.
Mr. Robinson, you missed the point. Nobody's arguing presentment. Now, what we're talking about, what does that mean? Physical presentment? That's a question Justice Spears and others have asked. Are you saying that the cases say that a person who requires or requests finding fact and conclusion of law must physically present those to the trial judge, even though he may be on the other side of the world?
No, the cases don't say that it has to be physically presented.
That's the issue.
I think, though,
you're also invited to tell us, you know, what should be the rule.
Well, I think that the presentment, if the rule is to be further clarified by case law, I think presentment is fairly clear that means the judge has to see it. That doesn't mean, of course, that the person seeking such findings has to hand it to the judge, but rather that the judge, within that period of time, has to see it.
Can that be done by certified lawyers?
Certainly can be accomplished in any number of means, so long as the judge does see it within that period of time.
You are conceding then that the certified mail is an acceptable way of presenting it to the judge?
If the judge receives it, yes.
Then you prove that at a hearing by calling the signatory and getting them to state.
Could that be proven?
I'm just wondering how this works.
Okay.
From a general policy standpoint, I wonder what interests are served by making it so much harder to perfect an appeal from a non-jury trial than from a jury trial. But that may be beyond the scope of a 30-minute argument, particularly when you have other things to argue. So I'll just narrow it down to what's the practical effect of how one goes. You think it's very important that the judge actually see this within the 10-day period?
Yes.
You think it's very important that the judge, within the 10-day period, physically see it. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Not that the judge see it some later time.
That's correct.
Which means that a counsel who has elected to go for a speedier and presumably cheaper trial, non-jury, and loses, has to make sure the judge isn't going on vacation or doesn't get sick or doesn't get assigned to another county through exchange of benches or assignment by the Chief Justice. I mean, you're putting tremendous burdens on the losing counsel here. And I'm wondering how we make this proof at a hearing. You've got to hope that whoever signed that green card is still around or isn't on vacation.
Well, of course, this is a rare instance where such a dispute would arise. But it is a burden upon
one. Well, but we in Texas give everyone the right to an appeal, theoretically. Constitutionally, we don't have to do that, but we do. Everybody has the right to an appeal.
This court has said almost 100 years ago that it's a fundamental right.
I didn't know that, but I'm glad we did. Okay, everybody has the right to one appeal in this state. It needs to be a meaningful appeal. And these rules need to be written and interpreted in a way that you can actually get that appeal.
Surely you're not going to require counsel for the opposition to travel from Brownsville to San Antonio to make a physical presentment of these requests of the judge.
No.
Now, what's wrong with the way you did it?
What's wrong with the way you did it is the judge, from the evidence in this case, did not get it until June 11th. Now,
that's not what's wrong with the way he did it. That was the result. What's wrong with the way he did it by doing it by certified mail? What was wrong with that?
I don't think there's anything wrong in judging it by the result. There was the things that were wrong in the method, as opposed to the result, were that it was sent to the judges, sent to the judge without being restricted delivery. It was received a day after, or it was filed by the clerk a day after the time limit ran. And I don't think that
you're not disputing the fact that it arrived on time, right?
No, it arrived in the judge's chambers, apparently. Someone signed for it. We don't know who. Someone signed for it timely.
Can we not read the signature, or what? Why do we not know who?
Well, it's a signature on that. It doesn't appear to be the name of Rogelio Valdez.
Well, but it's secretary, not. Do you concede it as a secretary or clerk?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Nobody was at this hearing. There was no effort to try to prove who that was.
Back up a moment, Mr. Robertson. You said something. I'm going to be sure I understood. On what date was the judgment signed?
May 20th.
Now, on what day did the clerk file a request for findings and conclusion?
The original request for findings and conclusion was filed on June 2nd. That's what was sent to the trial judge.
I'm talking about the date the clerk stamp is on.
June 2nd. There was a copy sent to the district clerk that was filed previously, but the original was file marked by the clerk on June 2nd.
Well, presentment is a court fashion rule and an opinion. Filing within 10 days is the rule 296. Are you telling this court that they did not file with the clerk within 10 days their request for findings and conclusions?
They did not. There was a copy filed within that period of time.
Well, that's sufficient. I mean, is there a clerk file stamp within 10 on the request for findings and conclusions within 10 days of the judgment?
On a copy, there is.
And on the original, it's within the rule 21A, 3-day notice, 3-day extension, is it not?
As to mailing?
Yes.
Mailed on. Yes, that would. Of course, but that was not mailed to the clerk, so I don't know that 3-day rule would apply. If it does apply, it would be timely.
Because whenever a party has the right or is required to do something or take some proceedings within a prescribed period after the service of a notice or other paper on him, the notice or paper certifying my mail 3 days shall be added to the prescribed period. I'll have to think about whether it's applicable. Do you think Rule 21 is applicable here or not? Short answer.
No, I don't. Although you're dragging me into something I don't know the answer to, is whether this should be filed first with the clerk or whether it should be filed with the judge. The way I read the rule is filed with the clerk and called to the attention and presented to the judge. That's not the procedure that the petitioner used in this case. But that's my reading and understanding of the procedure.
So you think it's the clerk that's supposed to present it to the judge?
No. I think it's filed with the district clerk.
First. Why?
First.
It says presented to the judge.
Because I don't think there's anything that's really filed with the trial court under the rules.
But it says presented to him.
Filed with the district clerk and then presented either by the person seeking such findings or however it is done to the trial judge or called to his attention. And I think that's where that a copy would be sufficient there as far as presentment. It doesn't have to be in the original.
Usually signed by the trial judge that he received it. And most of the lawyers put that in there on the original. They present the original to the trial judge, and the judge signs something there that says on this day it was presented to me on the original. Then you go to the clerk.
If you're asking about the general practice, my understanding of the general practice is it is filed with the district clerk first. It is then taken to the trial judge, and he acknowledges receiving it at that time. Of course, there's no evidence in this case to tell us one way or another as to what the general practice is. It's a tough question, of course, as far as when you have a situation where the trial judge is out of the country during that entire period of time or refuses to cooperate. But I don't think that it's necessary in this case to resolve that issue, and certainly there was no need to foreclose the possibility of an evidentiary hearing to determine why the person who was requesting such findings was unable to comply with the requirement that exists in the case law that it be presented to the trial judge.
Was there any evidentiary hearing here on who received this, when, or why?
I do not believe there was. Of course, an additional problem, and perhaps another reason that the requirement of presentment be maintained, is the interchange of judges as to the benches that they sit on, which of course occurs in Cameron County and occurs in many counties in which one judge will sit on another court's bench, and there's an interchange of benches there, and that this really should be called to the attention of the court, that to the judge that signed the judgment.
The other question I have is, when these findings were not filed, within 30 days after the date of the judgment, that is June 20th, I guess, thereabouts, was there any subsequent calling that to the attention of the trial judge within 5 days under Rule 297?
I'm going to defer answering on that because I don't know. And I'm sure that the petitioner will be able to answer that for the court. To move to the question, the other question brought up by the petitioner in this case as far as the award of the fee for the guardian ad litem, I think the court has brought up in question a critical point in determining whether or not the trial court abused its discretion, and that is that we don't know what the trial court intended the guardian ad litem to do as far as continuing services to the person that he was appointed to protect. We don't have findings of fact or conclusions of law to tell us whether the judge set that fee thinking that once that
hearing,
the settlement hearing was over, that the guardian ad litem could just walk away without worrying what became of the money in the future. This would certainly, it doesn't seem common sense that the guardian ad litem would be able to do that. Maybe the trial court intended that the guardian ad litem be charged until the child reaches majority, be charged with seeing that that money is protected from misuse by the person who has the care and custody of the child, protected from loss by investment, protected from loss by being in an interest-bearing account that perhaps did not bring the best interest. As far as the responsibilities, the petitioner suggested that the guardian ad litem does not have a great deal of responsibility in this type of situation. And I would argue and differ with that it is a tremendous responsibility for an attorney who is appointed to serve as guardian ad litem. Again, we don't know whether the trial court intended for the guardian ad litem to protect the interests of his ward in the future. Of course, because the responsibility there is great when the person who has the care and custody of the child comes in and wants to use money for one purpose or the other, sometimes coming in saying, well, he wants to go in the trucking business with me, he wants to live in a two-story house. This sort of situation is one in which the guardian ad litem
must take steps to protect the interest of the child.
Well, can you take it for a person, appointed guardian ad litem, that it's no conclusion to it, that it goes on until a child becomes an adult or when CM dies?
We don't know, in this case, of course, whether that was the intent of the trial court, and that it go on until the child reached majority.
And the guardian ad litem is not like a court-appointed guardian from a public court.
Under the law, no,
it's not.
There again, we don't know, though, to what extent the trial court wanted to
see. Well, if you believe that it was for service and getting the settlement together and of record, is it not around $1,000 an hour that he was being paid or more?
Well, that's if you assume.
Yeah, if you assume.
Well, there's no evidence as far as what.
There's no evidence it was a lifetime appointment. So if you assume that it was for getting the final judgment entered in the settlement case, it comes out at about $1,000 an hour or more than.
Well, there's some time that we don't have any evidence of. There's some time after the hearing that clearly the judge is requiring him to do more and required additional support from it. So we just don't know how many hours were expended beyond the 12 to 15 hours were expended up to the time of the hearing. There were additional hours, certainly there were expended. We just don't know from this record how many there were.
Well, that $90,000 in interest account is a little bit unusual for a settlement, is it not? But were there any parameters put on who could withdraw that money and how frequently and how much and for what purpose?
There was a limitation placed, a monthly limitation on how much the parent could use.
But it was within the parent's sole control and discretion.
No, I think there was just a limitation on the maximum amount that could be.
Well, I'm just trying to get at it, and I guess in more of an answer to Judge Stover's question, was there any possible
or likely
involvement of the guardian ad litem in the disposition of that $90,000? Or was that, or was the guardian ad litem out of the loop on that?
We don't know. We just can't answer that question on the basis of the record. And the judgment did not specify as far as the guardian ad litem.
There's $90,000 and the parent can draw up to X amount of money for the use and benefit of the child.
Yes, sir.
That's all it could.
It didn't say anything as far as the guardian ad litem's duties.
It suggested that there's something the guardian ad litem might be responsible for after the entry of the judgment to produce the final set. I've never heard of a situation where a guardian ad litem's
authority
or responsibility existed beyond the life of that lawsuit.
Well, it clearly
existed in this case.
Oh.
The court required a report as to where the money went.
What, one report?
One report.
From the ad litem?
From the guardian.
Don't some judges require the guardian ad litem that they be the ones responsible for the maintenance of the interest-bearing account, filing motions with the district clerk, and refiling for change of account.
To go outside the record, we don't have any answer in the record, but yeah, that is the normal situation, is that
the guardian ad litem is there for the life of that until the disability.
Well, sue the guardian ad litem. I can't cite any cases to the court, but in this day and age, I would expect that we would see such cases, and that this is another thing to consider in determining whether or not there was, whether the responsibility was great that the guardian ad litem assumes in working the case.
Do you feel that based upon the testimony that an hourly rate of approximately $1,000 an hour is reasonable?
Well, I'm going to have to answer your question in two ways, because based on the testimony of this case, it's not possible to determine that in fact is the hourly rate. But an hourly rate of $1,000 an hour could be reasonable or could be unreasonable, based on the other factors that this court has held is consideration. For Joe Jamail to come in for $1,000 an hour, that may not be unreasonable. That's one of the factors to consider, the reputation and experience of the attorney. There's no evidence in this case to tell us the reputation and experience of Mr. Magallanes.
If the settlement would have been for a far smaller sum, do you feel that there would have been an award of $15,000?
The smaller the settlement sum, then certainly that's a consideration. The smaller the award to the guardian ad litem. We don't know in this case whether the judge simply applied a standard uniform sliding scale as to an amount of settlement that he would award so much. We can't, and whether that would be appropriate or not, we can't tell in this case whether or not, because the record has not been was not developed at the trial court by the petitioner, nor are there findings of facts and conclusions of law. But it certainly could be excessive if that were the hourly rate. It may not be excessive in considering all other factors that the trial court was required to consider and the Court of Appeals considered in determining whether the trial court had abused its discretion. Of these factors that this court has said should be considered, there's only a couple that have been developed at the trial court for consideration here. And not knowing the other factors, I feel that this court cannot determine on this record that the trial court abused its discretion in setting the guardian ad litem fee at $15,000.
Any further questions? Thank you,
Frank. Initially, to answer the question as to the compliance with Rule 297 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, this is undisputed that we did again present a letter notifying the judge of his oversight in making and failing to make the findings of fact and conclusions of law are contained on page 374 through page 381 of the transcript. By letter, I believe, that was dated June the 23rd, that was delivered by Federal Express. In response to that request or advising of an oversight, the trial judge, by letter dated July the 2nd, which is contained on pages 413 through 414 of the transcript, refused to make the findings, initially saying that in this type of case, the findings of fact and conclusions of law were not proper, and secondly, that it was not timely requested because his clerk did not file the original request until the June 2nd of
1987. How was the June 23rd letter delivered to the trial judge?
Federal Express.
What were the requests that you made of the judge? Was it just a blanket request? I have not seen the instrument. I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to see the transcript. But was it just a blanket request to make findings of fact and conclusions of law, or did you have specific questions in there?
No, sir. It was just a general request to make findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Even if the judge had answered that, how does that help us in determining abuse of discretion? Without knowing what questions you wanted the judge to answer.
Well, the way I intended to do it is to see what the judge, what findings of fact and conclusions of law the judge in fact made, and then if there were additional ones that I thought were appropriate, I would have submitted them to him for his either inclusion or rejection, except as to this question of some kind of continuing obligation on part of the guardian ad litem to be responsible to the minor for an indefinite period in the future, which I really don't think that is or should be the law.
You don't think that's a requirement of some judges in some counties?
That's the way they do it in Harrison County, yeah. Mr. Hooks. We didn't do it that way in
Barrett. Well, to answer your question, Judge, I don't know. I guess that if the court requires it, then...
It's
then
either going to be the ad litem or it's going to be the plaintiff's lawyer. Of course, the plaintiff's lawyer has got his fee. He's closed his file. He's washed his hands of the case. Or the parents are going to have to set up a, go to probate court or equivalent county court of law and set up a guardianship so that they can get an attorney paid to do those things. Somebody is going to have to be responsible down the line.
What comes to my mind is that the guardian ad litem cannot perform any services or reach any decisions as to investment advice itself. That's got to be by court order. Basically, what the guardian ad litem purpose, as I understand it, is to advise the minor, to advise the minor's parents, and to advise the court, probably more importantly, what he should be done in this particular case, not to render legal services. As to change of conditions or change of investments in the future, really what the minor needs is either an attorney to prepare the proper motions and order and present it to the court and the court to make the decision on it, not a guardian ad litem to give advice to the court.
Why should the minor's money be invaded for that purpose? You know, the minor didn't want the money put in registry at a court to begin with. He liked it all so he could go out and blow it on a Trans Am.
Well, I think that's probably a burden that the funds must be subjected to adequately protect the minor and the minor's rights. But to get back to your earlier question, I'd like to respond to the first part of that. In this particular case, it's my position that from the evidence of the record and the facts of the case as contained in the statement of facts, that simply the court abused its discretion in granting the $15,000 attorney's fees for the services which the guardian ad litem performed in this case. If it's limited to the services that he performed, which would include the filing of one report of investment of the funds, then I believe that clearly the court abused his discretion. If you're going to say that there's a continuing duty on the part of the guardian ad litem, then truthfully, I don't know. It would seem to me that it would be an impossibility to say the trial court would ever abuse its discretion in awarding any kind of guardian ad litem fee, because if you impose the duty on the guardian ad litem to be responsible until the minor reaches his majority, you're opening Pandora's box. There's no way that anybody could accurately or potentially predict what the guardian ad litem was going to be subjected to, particularly if you're going to require him to possibly provide legal services in the form of filing motions and orders for the court's entry as to reinvestment of the funds or dispersal of funds. But if you limit the consideration to the record or what the guardian ad litem actually did in this case, then I believe the record is clear that there was an abuse of discretion, and I don't think it would be necessary to remand this case to the trial court in that event to make findings of fact and conclusions of law, that there wouldn't be any purpose served by that where we have undisputed evidence and basically a legal fact that where it's just an interpretation that the court under its powers could render this case and find a reasonable attorney's fee. Is there any more questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court will now take a brief recess.